Hello, and welcome to Dalkey Archive Press's Black on White. This episode is a long conversation with the late John O'Brien in conversation with Professor Warren Motte on the subject of why we read. We hope you enjoy.
John, let me, since this is about Dalkey and so forth, let me ask you, as a first question about how you came to reading, and about your own sort of itinerary as a reader. But when did you really start reading seriously?
I didn't until freshman year in high school. Up until that time, all that I read were sports books and sports magazines, all sports, even the forever boring golf magazines I would read. I had no interest in reading. Other people in my family were reading westerns and detective stories. It just bored me to death. I'd rather watch television, get it all in an hour. But freshman year of high school, this is almost confessional, I wanted to decide to what the rest of my life was going to be like. And who I was going to be. And I had no idea where to begin trying to get answers for that. I first turned to music, classical music, having no idea what it was. Classical music was something that was forever parodied on television as long-haired music. And it would usually be some goofy guy who was completely cut off from the rest of the world, who would be conducting an orchestra or playing a violin himself. So I had no idea where do you go to find. So I got an album that was at home of Monteverdi, and I thought that Monteverdi might be on the trail for me. I quickly found out that he wasn't. And I began listening to FM stations, and there was one, remarkably enough, that emanated from Elmwood Park, which was not quite the center of culture of any kind, except Italian culture, in the western suburbs. And then WFMT, which was the station I listened to constantly. So rather quickly, I would always be listening to music, primarily Bach, beginning early on. Bach was the standard and still is. In freshman year of high school, a teacher who was later to be let go by the high school, partially because of infecting my mind with these dangerous authors like Faulkner and Hemingway and Joyce, the very first day, he put up two lines on the blackboard. One was a quote from Randall Jarrell, and another was E. Cummings. And it just startled me. They're just incredible lines of poetry, which I didn't even recognize as lines of poetry, as much as just words put together. And I thought I've just stepped into a new world, and maybe it was the world I'd been looking for. This was quickly followed by T.S. Eliot, and he was basically teaching us college introduction to literature, not freshman high school literature, which of course is always putrid, sometimes not a cut above, some of the worst rhymes ever invented by mankind, and some of the worst stories. So I was enthralled by this, and begin trying to find authors on my own, things to read. At the end of freshman year, I asked him if he could make up a list of books, and he, I think, had one prepared of 100 books, beginning with Dostoevsky's The Idiot, which was my first serious book. And what a book to be trying to get serious on. It took me the entire summer to read it. Not a fast reader, never was. And so that was a rather daunting book. And all these Russian names that I had to keep turning to the beginning of the book. It was a cheap Bantam paperback. So where they show all the lineages of the characters and the various names that they could be known by. That was my first really serious book. But I was also reading widely because the names he would drop in class during freshman year. Colin Wilson, The Outsider. Do either of you know that book?
No.
It was just kind of a pathway to unconventional thinking. Philosophy, theology, literature were all thrown together. It was a remarkable book. And that became a kind of guide for me as well. Then I more or less had my reading list in front of me for the next few years. But what was I doing with it? And that's the question that I wanted us to be trying to get at. Why go to it in the first place? I was searching for something, and I thought the literature was where I was going to find it. Although in my readings in high school, it's just indiscriminate. Anything. It could be philosophy, theology, psychology. I was looking everywhere. My sophomore year of high school, and I've told Ish this, I made the mistake because what comes with that kind of reading and where you're trying to find yourself and you think you're going to find yourself in Hemingway, whom you read as a very romantic writer at a certain point in life. I read The Stranger by Camus. I did not need that level of depression descending upon me at that time. I was already bringing enough depression to the table, but I persevered. So it was anything, and I made no distinction between American literature, French literature, Russian literature. It was literature, which in some ways prepared me for the future and what kinds of things I'd be reading. So it was a search for myself, and it's very kind of simplistic way of answering this question, and I don't know if that's what drives other people at some early age. I suppose there's some people that just well-read, they begin well-read, always loved reading, and I didn't. It was really the search for something, and so it was American literature, especially Fitzgerald and Hemingway, but Melville, Hawthorne, and it was not for entertainment purposes. It was for serious pursuit of who am I? What did I want to be? This also led me to more or less cut off all social relations in high school. I'd play sports with friends, but preferably contact sports. Otherwise, I wouldn't hang out with anybody. I was reading, and that's all I wanted to be doing, be left alone and read. And that's how I became very unsocial, asocial, poorly socialized for 3 years. I've tried to maintain that those qualities onwards in life. But I was well-trained, self-trained at it. But it was a search for something that I needed, psychologically, emotionally needed, that wasn't around me. And it wasn't because I came from a difficult family or one that I was trying to escape from or I needed to escape from. That wasn't the case. It was that I wanted something out there that I didn't know what it was. So Hemingway, of course, at that age, presents you with this romantic, what you think is romantic view of things, until you discover that, and the sun also rises, they're all drunks, they're alcoholics, that's what's driving them, and you step back from it. I never noticed that, but you don't notice that until sometime in your 20s, maybe. Actually, I got some help noticing it from a brilliant professor at the University of Illinois. But that's also with The Great Gatsby, that romantic view of things, which, of course, which, you know, if you turn the book somewhat, is not romantic at all. It's rather awful, very much what America's all about. But that's what drove me. And it's only been in somewhat later years that began to look at literature as a body of things to be studied for other purposes. So, and that became the Russian formalist, of course, too, dealt with the issues of art and habituation and how to live. So that's always been my drive with literature, even though some people would say it's gotten rather precious and you know, the last 20 or 30 or 40 years. If you're beginning your literary study with the Russian formalist, but I was always abhorred by college classes at when I was in college because of the new criticism where you had the formula for how to read a story that which began with the assumption the author was attempting to tell you something that apparently he wasn't very good at because it took him several pages to get around to it. But you'd look for the symbols in the story, you'd look for the themes, and I mean, it was just awful. And I knew that wasn't what interested me in literature and wouldn't in the future, and still doesn't. But trying to find someone who, what I was then doing with literature, that I could turn to, well, it became Gilbert Sorrentino on the one hand, because I went to the graduate school of Gilbert Sorrentino, just as I was finishing the other kind of grad school. And with Gil as a guide, I'm so many authors I'd never heard of before, including Flann O'Brien. That's the first time I heard his name mentioned. He was never taught in English departments, but so many French writers that he was reading, Spanish writers. And I asked him to make up a list for me. Never been above asking for guidance with things. So I asked him to make a list of the books he's mentioned because I'd never heard of the authors before. And that started taking me in a very different direction. But I'm still looking for a way of reading and a way of looking at literature. And I read a book by, the Modern Poetry and the Idea of Language, Gerald Bruns. Do you know that?
Yes, I do. He was affiliated with Dalkey for a while, too, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. He wrote a few prefaces for us and mm-hmm. did other mm-hmm. kinds of things for us. And I reprinted that book. Yale let it go out of print some years ago. Mm. And the remarkable thing about it is that finally he didn't embrace the Russian formalist, but he gave him a very fair hearing. And nobody else was. The scholar who spent almost a lifetime writing about the Russian formalist completely disapproved of them, especially Shalovsky. Mm. And he accused Shalovsky of having been a coward and renounced all of his views so that he could move back to Russia from Germany, which is what Stalin was offering the Russian formalists, that they could leave, but if they came back, they had to renounce their formalist views. And based upon the one essay that was available, translated into English by Shalovsky, I thought, this isn't true. I don't think the person who wrote that essay could have recanted everything. And so the only way of proving it was to begin by publishing Theory of Prose. And indeed, he didn't. And now, you know, we've published a number of his books, including ones towards the end of his life. And he never renounced anything. He might have a page or two that were for the censors, you know, just to get into a book. And they weren't going to read the rest of it. So, but never. He was up to the same things that he always was. It's just that he was always mischaracterized. He's confused with the new critics in America, you know, who were really, I know it's simplistic to say they're a bunch of moralists, but that's what they were. They had nothing to do with the formalism in Russia. No. In fact, it was their enemies that cast the name on them of the formalist. They didn't. It's not a term that they were using to describe themselves. So that led me in a very different direction. But the beginning of readings, looking back on the past, I think of it as something that many people turn to because they are searching for something. And they're not finding it anywhere except in literature, which may not be the best place to look, because I think it can lead to a lot of problems. Life becomes more complex, and it might be also more delightful in some ways, but I think it leads you down certain alleys that may not necessarily coincide with the best of mental health, because you're in the companions of whom? these very complex people who are writers, at least complex in their works, but usually in their lives as well. And they're asking questions that are difficult to come to terms with. And so you set for yourself that attempt, and it makes life more complex. That's the best way of saying it. Or it completely messes up young minds and should be forbidden to the youth of America to ever read any serious fiction or poetry. So that's my way into it. It's as simple as that. It's changed over the years. Yeah, well, I had a brilliant professor freshman year in college, and it was an honors English course. We had to read a novel a week. Nobody protested against this. Yeah, everybody did it, in this class at least. And Brideshead Revisited was one of them. And I read that book and I thought, I've just seen the rest of my life. Winding up, I forget the exact wording that's used by Charles Ryder, with something to the effect of old and childless and alone. I thought, I think I've just seen my future. And I've turned out to be right. I love to be right about things. So I could really see a future in the book of where I was headed. But reading other, I don't know if any other book in that course, I'm sure we must have read Hemingway and Faulkner and some Russians and so on, but that was the book that had the biggest impact. And it wasn't with any great romantic energy that I looked at that future and thought this, oh, I can't wait to get to it. It was almost a sentence of doom, but so be it. So that's what started it in many ways. It's always been the case. I looked to literature to tell me something I didn't know about the world out there. I have strong views about how much literature has changed the world, and especially my favorite examples are American literature. You know, there wasn't any conception of the American male until Hemingway invented it, and then you began to see it all over the place. The silent American male, the oftentimes destructive American male, but also racism. I mean, I don't think there was a real sense, at least on the part of white people, of racism until Richard Wright created it. Invisible Man, came in after that. You just didn't see it. You weren't aware of it. That was a different... when I really got serious about black literature, was W. E. Du Bois is as brilliant as anybody can be in terms of explaining race in America. And his prediction that the country would flourish or die depending upon what he did with race. And this was back in, 1880, that he was saying this. And here we are, still with that big struggle that we've all lived through and are living through again. But without the novels that reached a lot of people, so Richard Wright, I don't think there'd be a consciousness of race in America, and there certainly wouldn't have been the civil rights movement, I don't think. So that, if you will, Martin Luther King was a creation coming out of the fiction of Richard Wright. That was, I mean, for me, the first real consciousness of race in reading that novel, and then began to see it everywhere. The practice of racism. So I think it's had, our literature is almost as much as it's dismissed now as kind of a rather pointless thing to be reading, spending time reading literature. It's had a lot to do with shaping America and even the politics of America. I think we're still fighting the fight of Emerson and Thoreau on one side and Melville and Hawthorne on the other, as to
John, what
it means to be human.
John, what prompted you in the early 70s to do your interviews with black writers?
I was reading the, if you will, the experimental ones, who was Leroy Jones, was a favorite of mine, and some few others. But I took a stance early on that there's a black literary tradition, and you can trace it back actually to Du Bois and on forwards to a number of the writers in the Harlem Renaissance. And it had certain characters, and it had certain themes in it. It had a certain storyline, plot in it that was this tradition. But a lot of black writers didn't belong to that tradition. According to the New York Times, all black writers belong to the black literary tradition because they were black. And so I was arguing it doesn't have anything to do with color. It has to do with choices that writers make. That's how they should be read. Now, they shouldn't be read as they are determined to write a certain kind of novel or a certain kind of poetry because they're black and that they can see things that white America can't see about itself, or that even some blacks, middle class blacks, can't see. That wasn't it. It was a very interesting and highly optimistic, unlike much of American literature, view of America and what was possible in America. That's what I was writing about in the introduction to the book. So I picked what I thought were the most interesting black writers to be interviewing. I could not get an interview with Leroy Jones because it was against his politics at that time to be giving such interviews to a white critic. So that was disappointing. But almost everyone else that I wanted, including Ralph Ellison, but some remarkable people who still don't get their due, like William Denby, who would have, had he been white, I think, been accepted into the metafictional group of writers in the 60s and 70s. But many of them were just very interesting writers that didn't belong to that tradition that I was describing, nor did they have to. But of course, in getting reviewed in the media, especially the New York Times, it would always be pointed out that the author was a black writer. Never would you see that pointed out about a white writer. A white writer is a white writer, just a writer. But black writers are always getting put in the ghetto and treated differently somehow, condescendingly, usually, but with oftentimes very little sense of where black literature came from in the long tradition of it in America. So that's what I was writing about, and little did I realize that I was causing some commotion with what seemed to me to be a very reasonable position, that writers could choose what they wanted to be writing about and how they were going to write. But that didn't settle well with some reigning critics of black literature. You were supposed to toe a certain line about black writing if you wanted to have a career. And I wasn't particularly interested in a career of any kind, just to be teaching in college. But I was warned by one of them that I was not going to have a career as a critic of black literature if I kept saying the things I was saying. Which, when I first heard, I thought he was saying that the introduction I wrote was just abominably bad. But I realized later he was saying, better watch out what you're saying because it doesn't agree with I'm saying, this one critic. And indeed, it wasn't agreeing with what he said. So the selection was just on the basis of interesting writers. There wasn't any polemic that I was pushing for in each interview. Ralph Ellison and I got into an argument, a slight argument of sorts. And there I was, I think, 23, interviewing this giant of literature. And I just began describing what I thought, the two twains of black writing, of just writing that happened to be by black writers and then writing that was in this tradition. And he said, well, you're white, and so you really can't understand these things. And I said, oh, and I'm from Chicago, so does this mean you can't understand anything by a white writer from Chicago because after all, you're black and you live in New York? And he just burst out laughing. So I said, are we going to go in this vein? Or are we going to talk about other things? And so he just laughed. He said, yeah, let's just talk now. He was an intimidating figure in all kinds of ways. Such a first-rate mind. And, of course, the importance of Invisible Man in American literature. So, but with other writers, they were just chosen on the bit. George Lamming was one who still doesn't get very much attention. It's hardly in print. I mean, he is in print, unfortunately, because I'd like to reprint him. But no recognition as, you know, a great writer in America. There are many of them in that book. H.M.L. Reed was one, whom I interviewed via the phone. And on the phone, H.M.L. sounded like Donald Duck. It was a treat having to transcribe him. But John Weidman was one early in his career. I think he'd had two novels out by that time. And we were both babysitting on Monday nights. And we both wanted to watch Monday Night Football. So we had to do it during halftime. It took us several weeks to do the interview because of our passions or our obligations. But it was just a gathering of interesting black writers. That's all there was to it, rather than arguing the thesis that I had in my introduction, but that's where it stayed, by and large. But black writers would ask me, who's going to be in the book? And rather quickly I caught on that some were going to be in the company they wanted to be in, or they were going to be put in the kind of company that was very popular and not necessarily very serious at that time in the late 60s, 70s. I didn't want those writers in the book anyways, but they were the ones that, you know, heavily adopted by white America as the black writers to be reading. And I didn't think there was much depth in them. So I went after people like H.M.L. Reed and Ralph Ellison and a whole host of others. A few were still around from the Harlem Renaissance. Arnold von Tomps was around, and it was just, real joy meeting him and knowing all those people that he knew from the Renaissance that had determined that movement in America. Ann Petrie was up there in years when I met her. And again, she was writing the novels she wanted to write. And of course, they were with black characters, because in the same way that white writers have white characters in their novels. But it was just, she fixed me breakfast at her house in somewhere in Connecticut. I forget the town, but I got there early on the train from New York, and she insisted on fixing me breakfast. And that was kind of the age difference. She must have been somewhere in her 60s, and there I was in my 20s. So Paula Marshall, really interesting writers, some of whom have, gotten more into the mainstream of American literature, and some of them who still haven't. And I think primarily because they were black and not accepted because they weren't, writing a certain kind of novel. So that's the story with black literature. And I never got to teach it. As I've told you, I would have doors open to me at for interviews, and a chairman would say, "Oh, you're not black." And that was basically the end of the interview. So they were hoping, because of the Irish name, and being from Chicago, that I might be black, then I would have been hireable. So the white liberals are the ones who kept me from ever teaching black literature. So, not that they aren't my dear friends, of course, but they are white, I should say white liberal academics. Those are the deadly ones to be avoided at all cost. I experienced racism from the other side, and I thought, yeah, this is you know, what I've immersed myself in terms of my doctoral work, and I'm really getting a first-hand dose of it. And I just assume, after it happened a few times, I just assume this is it. I'm never going to be able to teach it. And but I'll have the freedom to go off and teach a number of other things, and a lot of black critics weren't being given that freedom. They were being hired to teach black studies. But why would you hire a black professor to teach British literature or American literature at large? And I think that was, you know, academia at that time thought black studies wouldn't last. So they also didn't want, these white liberals didn't want to be hiring people who would get tenure, because the black studies programs would be eliminated by the time that they'd be qualifying for tenure. That was a very, very strange times, filled with contradictions about race and what it meant to be conscious of it and be protesting against many things and the hypocrisies that could enter into it, because academics, of course, were always on the right side, as they are now. Always the proper thinking that just gets twisted into something basically weird, you know. So on campuses now, of course, you cannot wish anybody a Merry Christmas. Like, there's a holiday out there that's associated with something or other, but we really can't wish anybody a happy one. We can wish all kinds of happy things to other religious holidays, but not that one, not on a college campus. I mean, you just twisted kind of thinking and shaping us into something or the propriety that's misplaced. But in the meantime, to go on with many of the age-old practices of academia. So, all right, have I alienated enough academics now? I could do that at my age, can I, Warren? I don't have to worry about that anymore. Who's going to be offended by whatever? Some people should be offended. So, that's my beginnings. Yes. How did you start? Were you driven by the same psychological needs I was to discover myself?
My beginnings were not auspicious, I have to confess. My first grade teacher called my parents into the school for a conference and told them that their young son, Warren, was incapable of learning to read. You know, the truth of the matter was that I knew how to read already. My mother had taught me to read before I went to school. And the problem was that I didn't read for my first grade teacher, whose name was Olive Whitehead. I didn't read for her because she intimidated me. She was a very, very scary figure, and she remains a scary presence in my psyche to this day, Olive Whitehead. So that, you know, that wasn't a very promising beginning for me as a reader. And, you know, I understand what you say about reading. I think for me, it became something else. I was an only child, and I was not very highly socialized and so forth and so on. So I read for company. Company. Reading, you know, kept me company, and I found people in literature with whom I was pleased to keep company. You know, William Burroughs said something that has always stayed with me in his conversations with Daniel Odier, published in a book called The Job. He says, and I quote, "My characters are quite as real to me as so-called real people, which is one reason why I'm not subject to what is known as loneliness. I have plenty of company," end quote. And I'm not a novelist, but I am a reader, and I see that very much from a readerly perspective. That, you know, the characters that I've run into over my career as a reader have kept me company, in a variety of different ways, and I've been very grateful for that company. I think we talked about Perec last week, and I keep coming back and back to Perec. And Perec, in the book of his that has made the deepest impression on me, it's called W, or The Memory of Childhood, says this about the pleasure of reading. I'm quoting here from David Bellows' translation. He says, and I quote, "This pleasure has never ceased for me. I don't read much, but I have never stopped rereading Flaubert and Jules Verne, Roussel and Kafka, Leiris and Kuno. I reread the books I love, and I love the books that I reread. And each time it is the same enjoyment, whether I reread 20 pages, 3 chapters, or the whole book. An enjoyment of complicity, of collusion, or more especially, and in addition, of having in the end found kin again." That's really interesting from Perec, it seems to me, that notion of complicity that literature can foster, and that notion of a kind of kinship built up within literature. I suppose I wouldn't say it the same way, but I understand fully what he means. And I think that idea of sharing, of sort of the generosity of literature, is a very, very important one for me. That the notion of a kind of a collaborative process, you know, taking place between an author and a reader, between even a community of writers and a community of readers, you know, be it real or virtual, it's very, very important for me. You know, we could also
talk Have you ever bought Go into ahead. The ideas that it reading makes us better people, or that it takes us places that we'll never go to, and that's the value of it? Get outside of yourself. Yeah, it's completely untrue. I think both of them are if you want to travel, you're not going to travel in novels. But especially making us better people.
Yes, I don't believe that. I see no evidence of it. I see no evidence of it either in the people with whom I'm acquainted, or in myself, to tell you the truth. I don't see any evidence of that moral uplifting reading has a lot of things that it offers, but maybe not that moral uplifting function. How about yourself? Have you been uplifted by literature recently?
Never. I think as I said, it kind of, it's dementing. It never even occurred to me that it was supposed to be doing that, making me a better human being. I mean, it isolates you in many ways, because you do it by yourself. I think probably many of the people I went to high school with turned out to be much more decent people and kind of people than that I turned out to be, because they did socialize and get to know people, and or they didn't. But it has nothing to do with reading one way or the other. But
that's true.
Reading,
and
I think,
chatted about this
takes
too.
You into. Yeah, it takes you into dangerous territories. But I'd say some of the most worthless people I've ever known have been avid readers. Has something to do with their ethics.
I think that dangerous territory depends on the... Thank you, John. I appreciate that. I think that dangerous territory depends very much on the book. You know, the territory that into which Saad takes you, for instance, is perhaps a little more dangerous than the territory into which you're taken by Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm, which is in its own way a very fine book, right?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. But yes, sure. Those are the books I didn't read in childhood.
I wanted to ask you, John, about what prompted you to create the Review of Contemporary Fiction and to found the press and so forth. Should we do two broadcasts about reading, broadly conceived?
Oh, well, we're going to go on with other people, and I'd like to hear what a lot of people have to say about this. So, yeah, we will.
Great. So, you know, what did prompt you to found, you know, the review, to establish the review, and later the Dahlke Archive Press?
Anger and indignation. That was it. It's still what goes on with it. And it really was. Everybody's wrong. Everybody's wrong about the writers they're reading and that they elect to be, to rank so highly in American life as major writers. And so many writers that are ignored, but that there's cash value associated with how writers come to be known and valued. And so many of the writers I was reading, nobody else was. So it was a rather selfish purpose of trying to get in touch with people who could write about them. But I wanted them to become better known and prove, well, once again, academia all wrong about what it was promoting. But the same was true with the press. I wanted to create an even playing field for writers around the world and to find writers who were doing different things in their countries that were most likely overlooked even in their own countries because of they were writing ahead of their times or writing differently. So I wanted to give voice to those writers because they didn't have a voice. And that's something that drives, I think the press, the characteristic of the press is the views of the writers within the works can be funny, what can be sad, tragic, that they come at it, the writers I tend to like the most are ones who come at it from those kinds of themes from a very different perspective. Oftentimes, they're characters who are lost. And, you know, who wants to be reading a book on the beach about lost characters, can't find themselves, or are at the fringes of everything, and are very aware of it? Some of my favorite books over the years are, really depressing books, but you get to know certain characters, and which is one of my passions with literature. One of the primary ones is characterization. You begin to get a sense of what drives people. And you develop, well, now it sounds like I'm promoting the idea if it makes you a better person, but at least promotes a understanding of people, certain types of people. And you begin to see them. The world becomes a wider space for you in terms of witnessing things and having a more complex view of what's at stake and what's going on among people. But it certainly was the case. I was infuriated that the writers who were being overlooked just never mentioned in academia in particular, but also the New York Times. We once did a survey for the review of trying to determine on what basis did certain writers wind up being taught, contemporary writers? And there was a direct correlation between being on the bestseller list of the New York Times and winding up being taught in the classroom. And if not necessarily on the bestseller list, certainly the ones who would get the glowing reviews, the writers you had to know in order to have conversations with fellow followers of oftentimes not very interesting writers. So, you know, how does that come about? And when you draw that connection, the New York Times dictates to academia who the important writers are. And the academics don't have to go in search of them. It says an awful lot about what gets taught and what kinds of students we turn out. No, I don't think I've convinced anybody of anything. It's still about money and fame. And the writers that get the glowing reviews, the front page reviews in the New York Times, still are the predictable writers. Occasionally, of course, they have to make mistakes and actually pay attention to some interesting writers. But if a writer is too unconventional, I'll tell you a story of something I did that's really perverse, and I've never talked about this publicly. One year, decided to write a letter to book review editors around the country. There must have been 50 that I wrote to. And I asked them to respond to a quote from a woman named Patrice Rousseau. I think maybe I identified her as French, if her name didn't give that away. She was not existent. It was me. And she castigated American publishing and academia and book reviews editors in particular for how safe they were and how they should be guiding readers into new literature rather than just giving them the same kind of authors and books as the important ones they should be reading. Oh, God, the response from the book review editors. They were ferocious in their attack on the French, which, of course, I'm not. And that every one of them said, it's the New York Times that takes care of those writers, those kinds of writers. And what did the New York Times book review editors say? Our readers really aren't interested in those kinds of writers. Foreign fiction, experimental, writers are going to stretch the imaginations of readers. We have to consider our audience, and our audience isn't interested. So it came full circle. Everyone pointed at the New York Times, and then the New York Times begged off of any kind of responsibility for taking risks and saying, here are the writers y'all should be reading, and giving space to them. And of course, that continues on to this day. But I forget whether I ran something in the Review of Contemporary Fiction about this without admitting what the setup was. But it was illuminating to me because I thought it might actually cause some of these book review editors to say, yes, we don't do that, and we should be doing that. None of them said that. It was all self-congratulations on how they follow what they assume to be the readers of the book sections and give them what they want. And of course, the New York Times now has descended, whenever you think it can't get worse, it gets worse, to reviewing, you know, what are certainly just genre writers and popular writers. They should give space to those writers. And then who do they ignore? I think the most interesting writers of the last 50 years are the ones they ignore, and they go on doing it. So, Gilbert Sorrentino wound up getting those in short reviews almost all of his life in the New York Times. There was one grand exception, maybe two, but both of them were connected to Random House. Since Random House published one of his books and then was being distributed, one of his other books being distributed by them, they pay attention to Random House. And if it's Random House, well, Random House must know what the public likes. So if you publish the same writer as is published by Random House, and sometimes we overlap with them, the Random House book is guaranteed to get widely reviewed, and ours tend not to be. So it's and it seems to be coming to a dead end, that book review sections are disappearing or have disappeared. Very few left. I think the New York Times is the only standalone section of the country now, and it's kind of good riddance to it all. We're in a kind of state of chaos now. Everybody has an opinion equal to everybody else's, but the end of the book reviewing profession really kind of died a long time ago, and yet they just, you know, like some kind of creatures in a horror movie, kept living on. But generally worthless. And I read in my early 20s, I subscribed to the New York Times book review section and the Washington Post, and I figured if a writer wasn't reviewed there, the book wasn't worth reading, which is what I think most people thought. And so I'd skip writers, or just not go out of my way to be finding them if they weren't reviewed in the New York Times. Ishmael Reed was one of those writers, although he tended to intimidate them so much that he would get reviewed, not necessarily with a great deal of pleasure on the reviewer's part. What I was angry about back then is what I'm still angry about, that it's really not opened up to a general public, and it's not easy to find certain kind of writers and certain kind of writing. You really have to search and search, and I think newspapers should be leading the way in doing that.
You know, you do have to search and search. I agree, John. I also agree that many of these people that appear in Dalkey's catalogs, writers from other countries, have not been recognized in their own country the way that they deserve to be. I'm thinking of a case in point is Olivier Targolat, whose book Narcissus on a Tightrope, will be coming out at Dalkey in the fall. He's written 6 very, very excellent novels, and he has not gotten nearly the attention that he really deserves in France for a variety of reasons. I think principally because his books didn't appear in one of the major publishing houses. They appeared at the Maurice Nadeau publishing houses, that's named after its founder. Nadeau was renowned for being able to spot literary talent, and his catalog is small but really, really superb. So, Targolat writes these novels very much against the grain, and gets very little recognition in France. I don't think that, the publication here in the United States of Narcisse on a Tightrope is going to turn the literary world on its head either. But it's a wonderful thing that it's going to be coming out in English and available to readers who, to Anglophone readers. It's a wonderful thing that his novel should be available for people who don't read French, but only English.
There's something interesting that happens when we publish writers from other countries, which is a good part of our list. Other countries will pick that writer up that have never published him before, and will do so, I think, on the basis of if an American publisher is publishing this writer, he's going to sell well, because we all know what American publishers are up to. So it happened with a number of them. For Eastern European, for instance, they might get translated into local countries, but almost never will they get outside of that loop. The Germans tend to be quite good about doing that as well. But for the assumption is, if it's an American publisher, it must, have an audience, and otherwise, why would you publish the book? You're going to sell a lot of copies and make a lot of money, which is far from the case, as we know. So it has that benefit, and which pleases me enormously. We don't financially benefit from that whatsoever, and it's almost by way of rumor that I'll hear about books being translated into other countries. And that's fine. That was something I hoped for with the review and with the press, that it would open up, if not in America, then in other countries, that these writers would start getting known.
How did you come upon your the house policy? How did you come upon the house policy of keeping everything in print, keeping your entire list in print, John?
Well, that goes back to my academic roots. There were so many books I couldn't teach because they were out of print, and so I started off doing reprints, only reprints, and I knew the books that I loved and the ones that had stayed with me for years. And that was all that I was intending to do, was reprints, and God knows there were enough of them. The tax laws changed back, I think, in the 60s, and it was farm equipment. when can you depreciate farm equipment? And the tax laws changed and affected books. When could publishers depreciate, their losses? And so a lot of books started going out of print that might have stayed in print longer had the government not changed the laws about farm equipment. So many of the writers that I started off was like Wallace Markfield, Sorrentino, Paul Metcalf, Douglas Wolfe, were out of print because they weren't selling, and companies couldn't declare them as write-offs. So that was the way to do it. Just a strange thing that happened at one level of government that then affected our literary culture. Now with ebooks, with the ease of getting used books, that there's less of a reason, perhaps, but still, there's so many books that are out of print and not easy to come by. And that's still, I think, more of my love than doing original books. It's thrilling when you do an original book that you know is a masterpiece, whether anybody ever agrees with you or not, and you're giving it light of day. That's it's a great feeling. But I think, my great love is preserving books and keeping them in print and having them available in bookstores so the readers can find them in the way that readers historically always have, despite Amazon. With the ease of ordering books now. So most of the books that, going back to my teen years, that I'd find would be roaming through a bookstore and picking up a book and starting to read it. And that'd be the basis upon which I'd buy it and read it. But there's less of a perhaps pressing need for reprints when you can easily find used books. Some of them will be outrageously priced, $800-$900. You'd think, who's going to pay this? It's an obscure book, but the price tag is there that is going to prevent that from happening. So a lot of our list, the books that forced to throw books overboard with the ones I think without exception be keeping are the reprints that I've done over the years. I know that those are great books. With the new books, you never quite know. You love them, and you can be loving them for reasons or things going on in your life that you love them, and then you forget them. Within 5 years, you can't really remember what they were. But those other books have stayed with you already. And those should be preserved and in nice editions and readily available. So that's really what I'd set out to do with the reprints. And it was the first original book of work of fiction was a French novel that Dominic DiBernardi and a co-translator sent to me out of the blue. I wasn't expecting it, and loved it. So I had to do it, and that was the first original book. Little did I know the dangerous territory I was walking into with all of that. Because you do share the commercial world. You've got to fight for the space in bookstores. You got to fight for reviews, and at times some of that can be threateningly compromising in terms of what you have to be saying about books. Some books that you think, oh, this isn't even really true, is it now? But you're trying to get people to pick up the book, read the jacket copy, and open it to the first page. But Warren, that, you do too, is when I first started with books, they were imitations of Gallimard, Lock, Stock, and Barrel, Outright Theft. No jacket copy, on them. Open the book if you want to see what it's like. And just title, author, and translator, if it was a translation. That's all that was on the front cover. No design. That was the design. And I still love that look. Bookstores aren't quite as crazy about it as I am. So I had to give that up. And then started imitating New Directions, the black and white covers that James Lachlan really invented for New Directions. It's the way I was able to find New Direction books in bookstores. Look for the black and white covers. And those were, Grove Press and New Directions were the two great presses, as far as I'm concerned. They were what they were, and they really changed the shape of American literature.
Thank you.
But part of that is it's also a business. So they had to get into the bookstores. They had to get reviews. It was such a great pleasure towards the end of his life to become quite friendly with James Lachlan and to be exchanging emails with him. And in one email, I said to him, the size of the audience for your books, my books, is 50,000. It doesn't mean you're going to sell 50,000. It means that's the potential audience. If they can find out about the books, and then there'll be some they don't like, but that's the size of the audience in a country this large. And he wrote back and said, 50,000, that's what it was in the 1930s. Now it's 30,000. So we're arguing over 20,000 readers as to what the size of the audience was. But that was a delight to be writing to him because it was like father-son relationship that we had going. I regret. I never took him up on his invitation to go out and stay with him. I didn't like travel in those days, and so I didn't. But the correspondence was a very nice one. And then Barney Rossett.
I was going to ask you about him.
Yeah. I never met him either. I mean, need to meet your heroes. And he started, when we came up with that issue, he started calling our office and was ordering like 20, 30, 50 copies at a time. And so I finally had to tell the person answering the phone, tell him he can't buy anymore. This is really meant to get out to readers and not just to be locked away in some vault. And that's what I was afraid he was doing. It would be reselling it to, rare book dealers and so on. As opposed to people actually reading it. So then POL, of course, is another publisher devoted an issue to, which I had such great admiration for. And in many ways...
Yeah, I edited that issue, I think. Right.
Yeah, that's right. What he was doing and trying to do with that is what I was trying to do with Dalkey. He bought rights from us once, and it was a disaster for the, and it was Wittgenstein's Mistress, which has sold enormously well for
really?
Us.
Really? The David Markson book, which is a terrific book.
Yeah. That was the only book he ever bought from us. And of course, we've bought many, many titles from POL.
Oh.
But POL, I mean, you do have these companies around the world that are up to kind of the same thing that I've been up to. And if you ever get around to meeting the publisher, there's a camaraderie that exists between you. There it is, sure.
And Reader's Block as well. Reader's Block is an incredible book, John. Incredible book.
Can I say one more thing that you'll put at the end? Because I don't think I've mentioned it before. We're coming out with a book that's one of the best books Dalkey's ever published, I think. It's by Zulfikar Ghosh. And
it's by whom, John?
Zulfikar Ghosh, Ghose. He's written several novels and some really wonderful
And what's the title?
Criticism. Kensington Quartet. Quartet part comes from Eliot. And it's really his... It's a very hard book to describe. It's a novel. But he just roams around in it, thinking out loud, or the characters thinking out loud about his life and what he thinks, quoting from certain authors. It's a book, I probably unfairly describe it as a book of ideas, which is very unpopular in America. But one of the reasons why I always liked Aldous Huxley, the idea that you could have characters who have thoughts. That's rare that you come across characters who have thoughts and they articulate them and they exchange ideas with each other. Huxley did that with characters, and he built some, created some very interesting characters out of it. Well, that's a part of what Ghost is doing in this book, I think. But it's also a kind of summary of his life.
The title is Kensington Quartet.
Yes, playing off of Eliot's The Four Quartets. It's
great.
Is that the date of it?
Inshallah.
Yes, God willing. All right. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, John. And
we shall meet again. Don't know where, don't know when. I'm making up this as I go along here. This isn't a song.
You've been listening to Dalkey Archive Press's Black on White. In conversation were Judd O'Brien, founder and publisher of Dalkey Archive Press, and Professor Warren Motte. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And rest in peace, John O'Brien.